Brooke from the SDM, Australia Defense Science and Technology Organization. I've known Henry for a long time since he was a grad student at UQ. I visited him when he was Michael Nielsen's student. Henry's done great work on fault tolerance and optical systems, as well as some other cool things with spin chains, all kinds of good stuff. And today he's going to tell us about fault tolerance and direct simulations there.
Thanks for the introduction, Steve. Yeah. And thanks for inviting me to come here and stay for a give the talk. Okay, yeah, so I'll be talking about some new ways to analyze concatenated fault tolerance from error correction and some new ways to try and simplify and improve these protocols. Standard introduction. When a quantum computer is eventually built, quantum error correction is going to be very important. So we need to understand well the physical requirements of performing quantum error correction. And in particular, of course, the noise threshold and the resource overhead. And we want to know how big we can make the first value and how small we can make the second value. As I'm sure you will know, there are two main types of fault tolerant quantum error correction protocols that have been proposed. One's based on concatenation and one's based on surface correction. And in principle, both types are efficient, but things can look pretty bad still. A couple of years ago, as Steve mentioned, I was involved in some work analyzing fault tolerance in optical quantum computing. And in that situation, for some fairly reasonable noise levels, we had with estimates of along the lines of 10 to the 13 to 10 to the 19 gates needed per error correction step. And in principle, it's efficient, but it still looks pretty ugly. It's not totally clear yet what type of protocol will be the best to use in practice, if either of these types. And the work I'm talking about today is focusing on concatenated quantum error correction. So the aim is to calculate the noise threshold and resource overhead of concatenated quantum error correction more accurately than has been done before. And secondly, to find improvements to these protocols, reduce the resource overhead and maybe increase the noise threshold. So I think a good way to carry out these aims is to come up with a new type of simulator, one that simulates many levels of concatenation explicitly. A very brief review of concatenation, which I don't think is required, but at least it gives me an opportunity to introduce this four-qubit protocol, which I'll be talking about quite a bit. So I've drawn here one of the simplest fault-tolerant quantum error correction circuits I know about. It's based on a four-qubit error detecting code. Here are the stabilizers and logic operators. No, it's not this short. I don't think it has a name. Knill used a code very similar to one that he encoded two logical qubits in his famous large threshold paper. But basically, it's almost the simplest code you can think of, a stabilized code to detect one error encoded by a qubit. And here is how you can perform an error correction circuit fault-tolerantly with that code. It's an example of a teleported error correction circuit. So these measurements here, all the measurements are in the X spaces, by the way. The effect of these measurements is to not only tell you the syndrome, these bits give you information about the syndrome of the Z errors, and these bits give you information about the syndrome of the X errors, but they also teleport the results to the other one. By the way, it doesn't matter that it's only an error detecting code, because when you concatenate error detecting codes, they become error correcting codes, so that's fine. There are lots of similar small fault-tolerant quantum error correction circuits that we know about for different size codes, 5-qubit code, 7-qubit code, but all of them are not going to be that useful by themselves in an eventual quantum computer because of the high physical noise rates we're dealing with and the very low noise rates we want to be able to do a large-scale quantum computation. We need ways to get very powerful quantum error correction circuits. So concatenation is one way of getting a whole family of very powerful circuits. Briefly, to perform concatenation on this circuit, you just need to
substitute each of the operations in your error correction circuit by their encoded form. So measurements replaced by transversal measuring, plus state ranges replaced by circuit for preparing the encoder plus, so forth with control phase. In addition, though, you need to insert these extra error correction steps on the encoded qubits at the lower level. So the substitution. And that is your procedure for performing concatenation. And for example, for two levels, that's the kind of circuit you get. It's now an error correction circuit on a 16 qubit code. And it's starting to look pretty ugly. So what I believe is that one of the best ways of understanding the performance of a circuit like that is to actually simulate them explicitly. So obviously the concatenation procedure is something you can repeat over and over again to get more and more complicated circuits. I'll just mention a couple of other things about this particular protocol because I'll be using it a bit. When you're constructing an error correction protocol using an error detecting code, your protocol needs to be able to deal with two types of errors, located and unlocated errors. And the reason is when an error is detected by way of a non-zero syndrome, you need to mark the entire block as containing an error. And at the next level of concatenation, that block is treated as a qubit that contains a located error. And the basic result in quantum error correction theory says that any code that can detect one ordinary error can correct the located error. So that's how, after two levels of concatenation, this circuit is able to correct errors. Secondly, post-selection. If a located error occurs anywhere in the shaded region, you need to throw that part of the state out and start the circuit again, and that's required for fault tolerance. Just another thing about this protocol is that I've omitted drawing some extra parts that really need to be talked about, and they are classical feed-forward Pauli operations. The results of each of these measurements simply control an X gate on these neighboring qubits. And similarly, the logical result of these measurements control logical X and Z Pauli operations at the output there. And you need to do that in order to keep in the code space, even when there's no noise. But there are these techniques known as Pauli frame techniques, which mean you don't really need to do these operations anyway. You can just keep track of them via special tricks. But even if you don't do these operations physically, they still act as a source of noise either way, a source of spreading noise. If this measurement result has an error in it, the effect will always be to introduce an X error here. So that's something that we'll map later on. So I just want to briefly talk about some previous ways in which people have analysed the performance of concatenated fault-tolerant quantum error correction. So one way that I've been involved in quite a bit in the past is this one level at a time numerical technique, where you take your error correction circuit at one level and do all these Monte Carlo simulations of it. You introduce errors stochastically and measure the rate of uncorrected errors. And then you extrapolate those results out somehow to mean levels of concatenation and hope that that gives you a good estimate of what's going on. But this extrapolation procedure is based on a couple of assumptions. One is that the noise on an encoded qubit is able to be described in the same way as noise on a physical qubit. So that's assumptions known as coarse grain. Secondly, that the error probability on an encoded qubit is determined just by the error correction part of that operation at the lower level. So the problem is...
Would you be in the same way?
In the same way. That an encoded qubit can either have an X error on it, or a Z error, or a Y error, or no error, whereas in fact, it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
So... The problem is
these are just approximations, and they're not, these assumptions are not really true, and they lead to inaccurate results. And another problem with this method is that there are certain things you simply can't analyze. If you were to try and include fancy ways in which concatenation levels interact with each other in a non-trivial way, you simply couldn't simulate that because you're only simulating one level of concatenation. So, of course, there are analytic bounds as well, and they've become a lot tighter in recent times, but they're still just bounds. And if your aim is to get the most precise idea of the threshold or other properties of concatenating fundamental correction, maybe they're not the way to go for that aim. So reasons that you might want to explicitly simulate many levels of concatenation are to get over these inaccuracies, and also the flexibility that you get by doing that. You might want to try things like message passing algorithms for decoding, see how that works in a fault tolerant context. And there are countless circuit rearrangements and simplifications you might want to try, but it's just too hard to do it, to try in the old ways of doing things. So I've got a first version of a simulator for this that I've just finished a couple of months ago, and it's sort of a cut down version so far. It only deals with concatenations of this four qubit code, which is why I've been explaining that one. It's practically up to about six levels of concatenation, and that's basically just a speed. You could go higher if you waited long enough, but for six levels, you get a 4096 qubit code, and you get a circuit that involves millions of gates. And I guess maybe a nice thing about this is that you're naturally limited to circuit sizes that may one day be practical to implement. There's no way in which you're going to be talking about circuits involving 10 to 20 qubits, because that simulator can't handle that. So we're just naturally restricted to reasonably practical circuits and seeing how efficiently we can make them run. But the simulator still just uses fairly standard Monte Carlo techniques. Errors are introduced stochastically at each gate and propagated through. And the aim of the simulator is to measure the probability that the error correction circuit at the highest level introduces an uncorrectable error. So there are many things you might want to try. But the first thing I'm going to talk about is using the new simulators to try and judge how inaccurate the old methods of simulation were, because there are a lot of threshold results out there for using the old methods. So basically, I want to simulate the exact same four qubit protocol, the same noise model and everything, but the two different ones, one with the new simulator and one using the old one level at a time technique. So just to summarize how you apply the old way in this case. So for this four qubit circuit at one level concatenation, you perform simulations for a range of different located and unlocated neural nets, and you'd measure the corresponding rates of uncorrectable located and unlocated neurons, and then you'd find some way to characterize the mapping from error rates one level to the next level. That's done by way of polynomial fit. So once you've got this characterization power noise rates map, then you know everything there is to know. You can find thresholds and whatnot. So that's the two things I'm comparing. So here are the results of the new way of simulating. Anyway, so what I've got here is effective error rate versus physical error rate for different levels of concatenation. I'm starting at two levels of concatenation, 3, 4, 5. As you'd expect, the more you concatenate, the steeper the effective noise rate is dropping off as you decrease the physical error rate. And as you'd expect, things are intersecting roughly at the one point, so there's a noise threshold happening at around 0.01. Okay, so comparing that to the old simulation methods, it's really quite different. You've got a threshold of around 2 times 10 to the minus 3, and you know, for any particular physical noise rate, if you'd simulated the old way, you would have estimated an effective noise rate far greater in some cases than is really the case. So it's perhaps a little surprising that the old ways are really that inaccurate.
But this is using the different decoding algorithm, really?
No, so I haven't got any message passing thing happening. So I'm using hard decision decoding.
Okay, so it's just basically the asymmetry of errors that's producing it that are no longer polarizing?
Good question. I don't think that's the case because even in this protocol, the protocol needs to mark encoded blocks containing a locator error, and when it does that, it marks both the X, Y, and Z. I mean, the unlocated error it knows about is uniform over X, Y, and Z errors. So when it does decoding, it doesn't take advantage of, well, yeah, the point in the protocol where the experimenter is marking blocks as having located errors kind of wipes out any asymmetry in the noise that's present at that point. So, so I don't believe that is a strong reason to explain the difference between the results.
Sorry, I don't understand. How does it wipe it out? I mean,
okay.
It only marks that if there's an error there, not the type of error. Still, it is that one type of error or another, and that carries up.
Okay, so the experiment is keeping track of this Pauli frame as well. I do randomize the Pauli frame. I did that to try and make it a more fair comparison. So I think that effectively gets rid of the asymmetry. But I have to think about that a little more carefully. But I did do that randomization to try and make it a bit of a fairer comparison.
So if it's not asymmetry, then what is it? I mean,
well, I haven't been able to work it out yet. I mean, I believe it's a combination of coarse graining and I guess it's a combination of those two assumptions, and they have a larger effect than I would have thought. That's just the dumb answer, but I can't really explain any better.
So how does the coarse graining differ from asymmetry?
In this method of simulation, you still have different things going on at different levels. A symmetry, you meant the symmetry between X, Y, and Z errors at a particular level of concatenation, whereas coarse graining, I mean, wipes out all the error information at any lower level, essentially, whereas here we still have error information.
But since you're doing hard decoding, that error information shouldn't really matter anyway. Except, and it much as it creates the type of error at a higher level.
That's right. Hard decoding will convert errors at lower level to extra errors.
The hard decoding will convert those lower level errors into unless maybe it's carryover between. But basically, it'll convert those errors, the pre-existing errors, into levels errors at the highest level.
But also errors at the lower level are interfering with each other when controlled phase gates happening in complicated ways too, and that's an effect that is not being accounted for any other way. If I had more time, I would have tried to explain, get a better explanation for why these results are happening, because I'm not totally comfortable with that larger difference. But I don't have an explanation so far. But I do believe it's correct. It's something that it is worth looking into.
Because you've also done simulations.
to check if it's this asymmetry deliberately introduced there.
Can you speak up?
So, I mean, to check if it's this asymmetry issue, you could deliberately avoid the logical blocks in the blue simulation.
Right. I do something. I mean, yeah. Okay. I think what I do is was equivalent to that in randomizing the Pauli frame, but when a located error occurs. But maybe I need to do think about that. Well, maybe that's not the same.
Wait. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd like to understand the difference better. So, well, so putting that little experiment aside, I'll talk about an experiment to see the benefits of using message passing decoding in fault tolerant coherent encryption. So what I'm talking about is modifying that error correction protocol so that the experimenter, for each qubit at every level of encoding, keeps track of a distribution of an estimated distribution over errors on the qubit. So this vector PI, PX, PY, PZ. And that replaces the idea of locating and locating errors. Instead of the experimenter either thinking that qubit is totally noisy, they keep track of a more finer grained notion of that. And as each syndrome is taken, that probability vector is updated according to, in a way that I'll describe a bit more. And that information is kept track of, and when you do a later syndrome decoding, you take advantage of it by doing message passing decoding. Basically, message passing decoding is an algorithm that will take advantage of the extra information. So the question is, does it improve the performance of the protocol? Just, I'll briefly review message passing decoding for those who don't know. Maybe most of you don't. So decoding in this context means when you measure perform measurement of an encoded qubit, you've got this string of zeros and ones coming out, and you want to interpret that as being a logical zero or a logical one. And the method that you use to do that is called decoding. So in the case of a four qubit code, just one of the concatenation measured in the Z basis, you'll always only get one of these four strings of zeros and ones, and two of them will correspond to the zero logical outcome, one will correspond, and two of them will correspond to the one outcome. And in the case of noise, for example, for 001, you wouldn't know whether it was logical one, an error here, or logical zero, an error here, so you conclude that you didn't know what the logical outcome was. So that's decoding for one level. For say you have many levels of concatenation, you're going to, in the case of say three levels of concatenation, you've got this big long 64-bit string of zeros and ones, and this is a case where there's no noise, just to start off with. But the procedure to decode is just in stages. You break your string of bits into blocks of four, and you do that same lookup in the table. So you replace this block by zeros and ones. And because of properties of the code, you guarantee that in your next string of bits, which is a quarter of the size, they'll also be able to decode in that way, and so on, and you get your result coming out. So how does noise affect this? You'll come across a block that where the pattern doesn't correspond to any of the proper code words, so you need to mark that as having a located error. And the next stage, when you come to look that up, you'll see that there's only one string that corresponds to this string differing in this one position. And we'll conclude that it's a logical one, and so forth, and correctly come up with the final logical outcome. So that's hard decision decoding when you have noise. So what about message passing decoding? In message passing decoding, you keep track of some extra information along the way. It's still a similar idea. When you have your string of bits from your measurement, you also need to have some a priori idea of the error rate from each of the bits. And in most cases, you won't have any notion of what one had more error than the other. So say in this case, they're all assigned an a priori error at the point of call. So in this case, even though this corresponds to a valid code word, it should be decoded to a zero, there's a chance that really it was a 0011 with the last two flips. There's some chance of there being an error in your decoding here. And that's something that's very easy to calculate. It's just Bayes rule that allows you to work out in each case what the probability is that you made a mistake in this step. And you just need to keep track of these errors. In the case of block with the error, you'll correctly work out that you had a 1 in 2 chance. So, but this just gives you a set of information same as what you started, but a quarter of the size. You've got a series of bits and a priori error rates on each, and you perform the same procedure again, calculating at each stage the probability that you made a mistake when you decoded that block. And finally, you've got the error, your bit logical outcome, and also an associated estimate of the error in our outcome. And sometimes that will be greater than 1/2, in which case you need to flip that bit. So there are two advantages of using message passing decode as opposed to the hard decoding. It tolerates noise better. The chance of this bit having an error at the end will be lower if you use message passing decode. And the other advantage is you get for free this estimate of the chance of that result having an error in it. So remember, there are things like this in the protocol where you're feeding forward measuring results. Now that you know what the error probability is in each of your measurements, that corresponds to a known probability of X error on this output given here, and that's how in the protocol you adjust your known probabilities of errors on each of your qubits. So David Plan showed introduced message passing decoding in the context of idealized quantum communication, where Alice and Bob both have perfect operations and that only noise is in the channel. And in that situation, in the depolarizing channel, it increases your threshold for being able to communicate from 0.0969 to 0.1885 for 5-qubit code. So it's quite an improvement in that context. But it's probably not going to be as great in all quantum from everything. Something I think to note is that it's just a classical cost to do this. So you always want to do it if it doesn't indeed give an improvement. It's very cheap. The complication is, remember, post-selection was necessary, and that was based on mental located error, because we don't have any notion of located errors anymore. So we need some way of deciding when to post-select. I'm not sure about the best way of doing it, so I've came up with an ad hoc measure of how noisy this state is. Basically, I'm summing the entropies of each of these distributions over the 8 qubits and setting this threshold whereby if the noisiness number is above that, then I post-select. If it's below, I keep the state. And you've now got this choice on how to set this threshold. The lower you set it, the more often you're going to throw out the state, and your resource overhead is going to be increased, but you'll be getting cleaner states as a result. So it's one thing that it's not clear exactly how to set that. So here are the results comparing message passing switched on to switched off. And to be fair, I've set the ether fresh in each case so that the resource usage overall was the same message passing, decoding, switched off, just to give it a fair comparison. In most cases, it's a clear advantage having message passing switched on, and the advantage increases as you can pack a bit further. And in this case, it's roughly an order of magnitude benefit. Though there is something funny going on up here, and I think that means I still need to refine my criteria for post-selection, that ad hoc method of choosing the post-select. But anyway, it is perhaps interesting to get an idea of just the benefit there. Here's one final thing, kind of obvious thing that I thought would be interesting to try with this type of stuff. When the concatenation procedure I mentioned required all these error correction steps being each time, you know, it's Okay, a fairly obvious question is what happens if you start omitting some of these when you concatenate? Because you're going to get a much simpler circuit coming out as you concatenate if you leave some of these out. But is it going to do anything bad to your error rates? Normally, well, there's a number of good reasons why all of these are kept in here normally. Basically, you don't want to go for too long without performing error correction on a few, because errors at a lower level can combine together to perform to create uncorrectable errors. So that's usually the story that's told. And also, in the old method of simulation, you really always need to have an error correction step associated with a gate, because the error rate that you assign to that gate is really just the error correction step. And if you omitted the error correction step, you'd estimate the error for the gate to be zero, which would be ridiculous. So it was kind of necessary to include it before in the old way. So anyway, the thing I decided to try first was the most extreme version, and that is to omit them all during the calculation. So instead of getting that for two levels, you get a much simpler that for your error correction step. And so forth, for more levels of thinking. So what bad things will happen if you do that? Well, so you can see that there is something funny going on. You don't get a really well-defined threshold, but things aren't too bad, at least at the high levels of concatenation, your error rates are still dropping off steeper as you concatenate more. So, I mean, in any practical situation, you know, you'd be sitting at some physical error rate and asking, you know, how low can I make the effective error rate as I concatenate? And you don't really care about whether there's a threshold, law-defined threshold or not. If you can do this with a much simpler error correction circuit, maybe that's the way to go. But
can you show, is there a way to compare, is there a slide that compares the amount of resources that you use?
Yeah, yes. It's all right. It's how do you know if you've done anything interesting or good, or how do you know if this is an improvement over thing for you? Or by looking at that, you can't tell. It's a bit strange going on, but it's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. And that is a good question. And basically, I was going to say that you could try countless combinations of which one's good and which one's not few combinations. So Steve, I think this is kind of the graph maybe you're hoping for. So what this is, instead of effective error rate versus physical error rate, it's now fixed the physical error rate at 0.002 just arbitrarily. And it's effective error rate versus number of physical gates per error correction step. And each point is labeled by this date and a subscript. So the date, this corresponds to some choice of modification of the protocol, for example, omitting certain error correction steps, message passing decoding on or off, heavier post selection just means to make that ether fresh but much smaller than it would be to make match the resource usage. And the subscripts mean that the concatenation levels. So here we've got, for that same protocol, we've got a few concatenation levels. So this is the kind of thing you'd kind of graph you'd want in practice. If you had a physical system with a certain error rate and you wanted to achieve a certain effective error rate because you had a short algorithm to do at a certain size, then you'd want to be able to read off what is the smallest circuit I can possibly use to achieve it. So you've got this trade-off between effective error rate and complexity, and points up here are the worst performing points and the points down here are the best performing. And you can see that in this case, the worst performing is the original four-qubit protocol with nothing further going on. And the best performing is with all of your error correction steps omitted during concatenation, message passing decoding turned on, not surprisingly, but also heavier post selection, which means it's reducing that ether fresh lower than normal. And it's the cumulative effect of all those modifications, even though they're fairly sort of obvious things to try, has been quite significant. So instead of an error rate of 10 to the minus 3, for this particular size, 100,000 gates in the circuit, you've gone all the way from 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 9 effective error rate. And because I just tried the most obvious things first, I can imagine that you might be able to squeeze quite a bit more out of that, out of a circuit of that size. And you're then in the territory of being able to do quite large quantum computations. Although I've totally ignored non-quantum group operations, which is sort of one thing I should say. Okay. So this still is the performance of quantum memory rather than a quantum computer. The early results show that it is possible to significantly improve the quantum error correction just with some simple things you can try. There are many more things to try, different codes, countless ways of doing circuit simplification for the arrangements, and cleverer ways to do post selection. And also, I'd like to, in some way, include maybe magic state distillation or so forth to include the noise from the group operations. I'm not quite sure how to do that yet. And the ultimate aim is to find the most efficient way of doing quantum error correction and to accurately measure its performance. Okay, thank you.
So, do you think, there have been some papers on locality, if you're only allowed nearest neighbor operations.
Yes.
Do you think you'd be able to include something like that?
Yes.
Swap operations and things like that. How much do you think it would affect me?
Well, that's a good question. At the moment, there's no notion of locality in this way, and it maybe require a little bit of work to include that. But you probably are aware that there are estimates of thresholds in local schemes, and they're not too much worse the way that I've estimated them anyway. At least for two dimensions, the threshold, you don't get too much of a penalty, as opposed to.
I guess I'm also wondering if there's. Presumably you'd see the same effect. I don't know if it would be more or less pronounced of the level-by-level simulations versus your global simulator. If there'd be a big difference there. It's not very one way or the other.
That's a good question. I'm not familiar with the ways in which these threshold estimates with local interactions have been estimated, something that would be fairly easy to try and estimate. One thing to add to the list of future experiments.
More things to try.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank you again.